Praise be to Allah, you tarnished Andrews. So here's the crack with this week's fucking podcast. It's Tuesday, right? And I had a big fucking podcast planned. Not a big podcast, but I had a boiling hot take planned for this week's podcast. And the shtick was is that I won't spoil it for you, but I was going to start off talking about a jacket. And this jacket, the hot take about this jacket, was eventually going to end up with me talking about a Nazi eugenics program. And I've all the research done. But here's the stick. It's Tuesday. Earlier on today, I was invited out for a meat and cheese platter in a restaurant in Limerick called Di Vincenzo's. A meat and cheese platter, which I can't really say no to. You've got fucking salami. That's my extent of knowledge of cured Italian meats. But several Italian meats and several Italian cheeses on a platter that you eat with some olive oil and bread and a few glasses of wine. And this was at 1 o'clock in the day, so I was like, fuck it, I'll go for that. Sounds class. So I went out for it with a dear, dear friend of mine who's a woman. And before I knew it, the cheese platter was fucking lovely. The meat was lovely. I'd said one glass of wine. Before you knew it, it turned into two glasses of wine. Got out of hand at about 3 o'clock. And I was drinking pints. So I'm a small bit shit-faced at the moment. And I said on Twitter earlier, I said, I got poured a pint of Peroni, right? Now, Peroni isn't my usual tipple. Peroni is an Italian beer. But it's a very crisp, enlightening, refreshing beer. And when I asked the boys in the Italian place for the Peroni, they said, can you hold on a minute? Because we're changing the tap. We got to get a new barrel. So they changed it. Gave me the Peroni in a new fucking barrel. And it was as if God had wanked into my mouth. The Peroni was so fresh, so beautiful, so sparkling, iridescent, like the inside of a fucking pearl. Not the inside of a pearl, but like pearls come out of, here's an interesting thing about pearls. Pearls come out of oysters, right? And the word iridescent refers to anything that has a pearlescent quality. When you, hold on, someone's coming into the room. I'm recording my podcast. I'm recording a podcast. So anyway, when you fucking, the thing with oysters, right? So oysters, in the inside of an oyster, if you were to look at an oyster and the inside of its skin or its face or whatever you call it, it looks pearlescent, right? The skin of that oyster looks like a pearl. What happens is that when that oyster is in the bottom of the ocean, occasional oysters, not every oyster, and it's almost like how plaque forms on your teeth, a bit of dirt will go into that oyster. And it will situate itself and it will ingrain itself in that oyster's skin. And then what happens is that the pearlescent quality on that oyster's skin grows around that bit of dirt over and over until you're left with a pearl. And that's what a pearl is. It's like an oyster's gammy tooth. And we as human beings value this as something that you need to be worn around your fucking neck. What was I talking about? Long story short, alright? I went out for a cheese and meat platter with a good friend. And this beautiful pint of Peroni came in front of me. It was so gorgeous that I couldn't stop. Now I'm a small bit shit-faced. I'm a tiny bit drunk. I'm not even smoking my fucking vape. I went and bought fags. I bought actual cigarettes, which is something I don't usually do. Now, not only did I buy a fucking pack of cigarettes, I was preparing a meal the other day. It was a potato and aubergine curry. And 2 days ago, boys, 2 days ago, I cut the top of my finger while chopping an onion. and the cop was grand, they looked after it. It has reopened itself. So I'm sitting here today, still drinking a can of Rockshore Lager, which I bought Rockshore Lager from a place of anger. It's this new fucking lager that they're trying to, I think Guinness own it, and they're trying to position it as a craft lager. I went into Tesco and I saw 8 of them and I said, I'm fucking buying you, you cunt. And because I was angry with it. Because I was like, I know you're pretending to be something you're not. It's just fucking Heineken and a Widener. Or a Bonner. So I'm sitting here smutting a fag. My thumb is pumping blood. Because I've reopened a cut from a potato and aubergine curry that I had the other day. I'm drinking Rockshore Lager. And I'm in no position to be delivering ye the podcast that I intended to deliver. I intended to have a very boiling hot, cognizant take about a jacket which led to a Nazi eugenics program. And I won't do it justice this week if I speak about it while I'm kind of fucking pissed. You don't even get that lovely sound of my vape because I'm smoking a fucking cigarette like a fool. So what am I getting at? So also as well, right, while I was out having this meat and cheese platter with my dear friend, I asked her, I was talking about one of the boys. And I said, do you fancy him, right? And she said, do I fancy him? And I'm like, yeah, do you fancy him? And she goes, he's thick. And he thinks every woman is thicker than him. That's the most unattractive thing ever. I roared out laughing at this. I thought this was the funniest thing I've ever heard. It encapsulated male privilege in a nutshell. This lad that we know, God bless him, he's not the brightest of lads. I don't like even saying words like that, but he's not too smart, alright? But not only is he not too smart, he thinks that every woman is thick. And she pointed this out. So I wrote it up on Twitter. Put it out as a tweet. It was that funny, I tweeted it. And for some reason, a load of boys underneath, they started tweeting, didn't happen. That wasn't real. That conversation never occurred. Because the idea for them of a woman evaluating their intelligence was so painful that their unconscious pain sublimated itself to their conscious, and it expressed itself as them telling me that it didn't actually happen. That is so painful to me, I must have made it up. I'm sorry to tell you, boys. But some girls are interested in intelligence. And my buddy was interested in intelligence. And it's a weird fucking thing that lads do. When lads on Twitter find a piece of information that they don't find uncomfortable, they tweet, didn't happen. That did not happen. You made it up. Which resulted in me having to tweet a photograph of the girl that I was with holding up a piece of paper on which was written, I said it. To prove to the boys, yes, it happened. What I'm getting at, I'm too mouldy to do a podcast. I've had too many cans. I've had a couple of wines. I had an Aperol Spritz, which I never drink, but I had it for the first time. But I'm well into it now. And it would be a foolish move of me to be delivering ye this hot take about a jacket and Nazi eugenics, to be doing it the service that it deserves while on several cans. So I'm not going to do it. Instead, what I'm going to do, because fucking leave me off. Do you know what I mean? Part of the crack of this podcast not being on fucking RTE or BBC. Imagine Ryan Tuberty turns up one morning and says, I'm not doing the show, I'm pissed. Do you know, like, Britain would reinvade. But because we have this beautiful podcast and it's a socialistic model, you know, we've got the Patreon account. Subscribe to the Patreon if you wish. Blind Boy. The patreon.com/theblindboypodcast. Subscribe to that if you want. because we have this model, I feel it's okay for me to say, this week, lads, I went out, I got langers, and I can't deliver the podcast, and it's grand. So instead, what I'm going to do, is there someone at the fucking door? Some cunt outside on a scooter. My housemates after ordering a pizza. Anyway. Yeah, so this week you're not getting the full fucking podcast. So what I'm going to do instead is... And I promised I wouldn't do this. And there's going to be a part of myself that will be pissed off at myself in the morning. But it feels right. Like... I'm going to give you a live podcast instead. Even though I said that the live podcast has got a different mood to the podcast hug. And I will do it once a month. On this Wednesday, allow me to get langers on daytime drinking. And I'll give you a live podcast, which is slightly different to your podcast hug. But this podcast as well. Inspired by... There's a slight anger in me. When I tweeted that thing... About my buddy talking about the lad saying that he's thick and he thinks every woman is thicker than him and that's the most unattractive thing ever. Because of those boys that were getting pissed off about that, I am going to put out my live podcast that I did with the author Louise O'Neill, who is one of the most important voices in Irish society today. She's a feminist author. She writes fiction for young adults and for adults. And I recorded this podcast with her in Kilkenny about a month ago, 2 months ago. And it was a full packed out room, 400 or 500 people. A lot of men left the room because the shit that she was talking about made them uncomfortable. And all she was talking about was women's sexuality. She was talking about sexual assault. She was talking about masturbation. And it caused men to leave the room. So I'm going to play Louise's live podcast. Because I think you need to hear it. And this is for the lads specifically. And don't get pissed off at me in a week's time and say, I didn't like that podcast. I'm unsubscribing from your Patreon. Don't project misogyny on top of me. Or your uncomfortableness on top of me. Just listen to it. Listen to it and enjoy it, because Louise is somebody who needs to be listened to. I was going to put it out at the end of this month, but... What can I say? I had a few too many cans. Let's see, fucking... A fly just landed on my hand. That's the other thing as well. What the fuck is going on? This particular time of summer. There's certain flies. And they're just flying around the gaff, as flies do. But they just want to land on your knee or your hand and say, what do you want with my knuckles, sir? Do you know? And it's just chilling out there. And I'm not the type of person who'll kill a fly. I'm not into it. Only the other night, actually, maybe they want the fucking blood on my thumb. I love Spanish cuisine and I love Spain, as you know, because I fuck off to Cordoba once or twice a year. But there's a type of food I'm after flicking. I'm after flicking fucking fag on my crotch now, and it's very unpleasant. Hold on. On my Puma tracksuit pants. There's a type of food that they have in Spain called tapas. And tapas, basically, I think it's a type of culture that would be of great benefit to Ireland, because what tapas does is that it stops you drinking. It makes you eat a bit of food. Instead of fucking going the whole way and having 8 or 9 pints. But how tapas came about as an invention. There's these cunts of flies in Spain. So if you've got a pint out, or if you've got a bit of drink or a wine or whatever, these flies come straight over to your drink and are like, how are you getting on? Can I have some of that? And you as a human being is like, get the fuck out of my glass, sir. But the flies come over, and I had it last week. I had a lovely piece of fucking drink. Flies came over to it, and I'm like, how can I stop them? Tapas was invented because, and tapas is like small pieces of food. It was invented because people were drinking drink, flies were coming over, so the barman started going, Kamam may give you a biscuit and a bit of cheese and you can cover your drink with it. So that's what they started doing in Spain. The flies were so antisocial that an invention, a culinary invention, had to come about whereby your drink is covered with a biscuit, and this evolved into an entire revolution of food known as tapas. So that's what this week's podcast is going to be about. It's going to be an interview with the author, Louise O'Neill. I know the women who listen to this podcast are going to listen to it because women love Louise for good reason. But for the lads, just listen to this. Listen to this interview. Sit with the uncomfortableness. If you feel uncomfortable during this interview, like the lads who were there at the live podcast, something about that is confronting you with a darkness in you, a misogynistic darkness. Sit with it. Fucking live with it. Hear it. Listen to it. Do you know what I'm saying? Challenge it. Don't walk away. Challenge it. Like, last week's podcast was about fucking transactional analysis, and I got several very pleasant mails from all of ye talking about how it helped ye. Personal growth comes from sitting with shit that makes you uncomfortable. Not the pang inside of you to walk away from it. Fuck that. Sit with it. That thing that makes you feel uncomfortable, that thing that makes you feel emasculated, sit with it. Live with it. Observe it like a fire. And personal growth will come from that. Fucking listen. Use your ears. Do you get me? As uncomfortable as it may be, just live with it. And from that, you will grow as a human being. All right, I'm going to do a very paltry ocarina pause before I go into the interview, because we know well, the fucking black and tans are going to try and advertise on the podcast. The fucking British Army cunts are going to try and advertise on the podcast. So I'll give you a little, an early ocarina pause.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
God fucking help anyone who is arriving at this podcast for the first time. I'm not even explaining the ocarina pause for you cunts. Go back to the start, you goals. So I just pressed the record button, which means that the live podcast has officially begun. So I'm going to bring on my guest. She's a fantastic author. Her name is Louise O'Neill, and she's from Cork. Louise!
Most important thing is that he acknowledged I'm from Cork. That's all he needs to know.
There you go. Yeah. So throughout this, Louise, right, I have the questions to be asked on my phone.
Okay.
The reason I'm flagging this is that I've done a couple of podcasts where I've had a guest on and the questions are on my phone. It just looks like I'm looking at text throughout the interview,
so
like
bored.
A prick. So what I did was, whenever I do a live podcast,
I like to ask Twitter for the questions to kind of democratize it.
It's a terrible idea. But anyway, what you do, it's your podcast. So.
It was great. There were some fantastic questions. And what I loved was, well, I didn't love it. The questions from women were brilliant.
Yeah, oh God.
And then the questions from lads were just very passive aggressive and shitty.
Why does she hate men? It's like, just
well,
stop.
Well, that was the higher end of the spectrum. Yeah. Like, the lads that were owning it and going, she's a feminazi, going, okay, you've outlined your position.
Yeah.
But it was the lads that were saying, ask her about the inside of a tennis ball.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? At least own your misogyny. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So...
You're not going to ask me about the inside of a tennis ball, are you? Because I have no idea.
We might talk about the inside of a tennis ball. That's a weird thing in Irish culture, the inside of tennis balls, though, isn't it? Do you remember in school the inside of a tennis ball punishment essay? That's a thing, isn't it? Did you not get that?
No.
Does that resonate with you? If you were messing in class, and a teacher wanted to give you punishment... Like, sometimes if you're a bad student, punishment is a good thing because it means, oh, I've got detention. I can actually get homework done. Mm. So a really nasty teacher would go, you've got detention for 4 hours. You must write about the inside of a tennis ball in 2,000 words.
Yeah.
Which I used to love.
Yeah. I can imagine.
I'm like, yes, I will write about the inside of a tennis ball. Absolutely. I remember I had three separate write about the inside of a tennis ball essays. And one of them,
I really want to read these now.
I wish I still had them. One of them was about, it was an alternative story about Christ, anyway, found his way into the Cú Chulainn story. So what happened in this, I should have fucking kept it, I was only about 15. So basically, Cú Chulainn is facing the dog, right?
Okay.
And instead of a slitter, it's a tennis ball. So then, as Cú Chulainn hits the tennis ball, as it goes towards the mouth of the dog, Christ, who'd been a teenager and messing around with time travel or whatever, finds himself at that moment between Cú Chulainn and the dog, so the tennis ball goes into Christ's mind.
Ah, okay.
And then the rest of the story was about Christ's gospel being kind of destroyed because he had the brain of a tennis ball. And for that, I was chastised by the system. As opposed to recognising that I had a bit of an imagination. So you've written 4 books, you've written 4 novels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a few questions I want to ask first. Like, you're mainly seen, well, not mainly seen, but if I read about you, they sometimes describe you as a young adult author. Mm-hmm. Now, your most recent book is not The Surface Breaks, Almost Love.
That's for grown-ass
adults.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was weird. I think at the start, I didn't necessarily think I was writing a young adult novel.
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
Yeah, because it was, I suppose I just wanted to tell the story the way I felt that it needed to be told. And then it was when I started going to agents and they said, oh, you know, we think this would do well in a young adult market. And I was like, thinking of that John Green money, I was like, yeah, that's a great idea.
That was my assumption.
Yeah. I mean, it's all about the art.
But like, yeah, you didn't sit down one day and I'm gonna like young adult is like 12 to 18.
Yeah, even though mine have always skewed older. But I remember when they first started submitting it to publishers, they kept saying they were like, oh, we think this is slightly too dark for this age market. I was like, have you ever met a teenager in your entire life? They're not dark enough, to be honest.
Yeah.
But definitely, I suppose with asking for it. But with all of the books, there's always been sort of a crossover appeal, and they republish them as adult editions because I think they could see that it would do well in both markets. So.
And the protagonist in Asking For It, she's like 16, 17?
She's 18.
She's 18. Because you wrote her in the first person, right? Do you feel that you spoke from the language and point of view of an 18-year-old, and because of that, when a publisher read it, they were like, this sounds like a teenager?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose I had a two-book deal when I sold Only Ever Yours, and I suppose with Asking For It, I don't know, I feel very in touch with that sort of part of myself anyway. I think for most people, like, our school years were so difficult that they still remain like very fresh in our memories. And I also suppose it's a time of a lot of firsts, you know, it's like the first time you have sex, the first time you fall in love, the first time you're heartbroken. So all of that feels very immediate. So it was quite easy for me, I think, when I was starting to write, or maybe I'm just incredibly immature, I'm not sure. It's one or the other. So it just felt really easy for me to sort of get that voice. And, you know, I had my next door neighbor who was around turned 18 at the time, and I had her read it just to make sure that some of the language was okay. But I don't think the inherent experience of being a teenager
that doesn't has, change.
Yeah, you know, that's it, that kind of remains the same.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the book Asking for It?
Yeah.
It is a book about a girl called Emma, who is like, would you call her a nerd?
No,
she's
I think
good at school,
well,
isn't
I was
she?
Gonna say that's the nicest thing. usually people say she's such a bitch, and then they're like, is she based on you? And I'm like, I'm not sure what impression I'm giving here, but no, she's not. I suppose she is good at school, but she's, you know, she's the most popular girl in her class, and is very obsessed with sort of her sense of self and her beauty and the effect that she's having on men. And I suppose that was a very deliberate choice that I made, because I think that all too often we find, as a society, we find it really easy to have sympathy for victims of sexual violence if they behave in certain ways, whereas if they don't, you know, if they've been drinking, or if they've taken drugs, or if they've worked as a sex worker, if they've been promiscuous, and I think all of those things tend to be obstacles in the way of seeing any justice, because you know that that's going to be brought up in court if you do attempt to, you know, to take it that far. So I think I wanted to create a character that might be unlikable in ways to, I suppose, really just emphasize the point that, you know, it doesn't matter whether people are, like, if someone comes forward and they disclose being raped, it doesn't matter whether you like them or not, like, they still deserve to be believed and to be listened to.
Yeah, and, like, if someone's house got robbed.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't say, well, you're dead, so you
shit.
Deserve it, yeah.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? But, like, this book has become really incredibly relevant recently because of, we said, the Belfast trial. And that's what some of the questions on Twitter were about. Like, how do you feel about that? Because the book was brought up quite a lot in the media when the Belfast trial was happening. I'm sure you got quite a lot of phone calls, did you?
I did. I got a lot of messages from friends and from people in the media. And I was actually really...
Sorry, just for people who don't know, this girl, Emma...
She goes to a party and she takes MDMA and she passes out. And the next morning she wakes up and she's been thrown on the front porch of her house, and she's no recollection of how she got there. And it's only when pictures start to emerge on social media that she can put together that she was the victim of a brutal gang rape. And then really, I suppose the book is more about how her community reacts to it, how her family reacts to it, how that's actually, for a lot of victims, much more traumatizing than the event itself, is actually the reaction of people and their reluctance to believe, especially if they know the person that you're accusing. So it was when the Ulster rugby rape trial occurred, from the very beginning, I was getting a lot of messages from people saying, you know, the similarities are uncanny. And I think I felt very reticent to sort of talk about that. You know, I never really replied to anyone on Twitter when they said that, because I think I was always very wary of the idea of sort of nearly capitalizing off the back of that,
like,
you know.
I mean, your character isn't real, it's fictional, but then you've got this thing going on with a real
person. Absolutely. And, you know, people kept saying that, they were like, oh, Asking for It started a national conversation. And I always said, well, I'd prefer to have those conversations off, like, the back of a piece of art rather than, you know, a young woman's lived experience. But when the verdict came down, I was asked to write a piece for the Irish Examiner. And I did mention the book in that, just because I felt like I had to. And it just, I felt really proud of that. I felt, because I had to write it. They rang me and they were like, we need this in 2 hours. And I was on the train and I had to write a 1500 word piece on the Notes app of my phone. That was just torturous. They published it the next day, and the headline was, I Believe Her. And I just felt like it was such a
strong... Did you choose that headline?
No, they chose it. I didn't
have
a clue.
That's the fucking problem with journalism, man.
But no, I was actually... I thought, you know what? Yes. Well, I mean, I'm afraid now getting
myself
into
trouble. So much negativity that I've seen about you was because of that headline.
Yeah.
And not the content of the article, like.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the thing is, I suppose I always knew with the topics that I wanted to write about and the things that I wanted to say, I suppose when you're speaking truth to power... there's always going to be people who don't want to hear that. I remember before Asking for It came out, my father was the first person to read it. And I was a little bit wary because, you know, he's lived in Clonakilty his whole life, you know, he's real sort of small town, he played football. And I was a bit concerned, and he sort of sat me down and he said, you know, this is going to be a really important book. And he said, I hope you're prepared. And I said, prepared for what? And he said, there's going to be people reading this book. Some people will realize that they've been raped. Some people will realize that they've raped someone.
Fuck.
And he said, and those people will not want to have that realization, and you're the messenger. And he said, you know, he just said, I just want you to be prepared. And I kind of, There's nothing that can prepare you for that. There's nothing that can prepare you for people hating you just because you've tried to argue that maybe equality is a good idea.
Yeah.
But, you know, you just have to, I just try and switch off and not, you know, I don't read, you know, I don't search for my name on Twitter. I don't look at boards.ie. I don't, you know, do all of that kind of thing.
Oh, you should go to boards.
Yeah. I would never sleep ever again. I would be like, oh my God.
That's a fucking sewer.
Yeah.
But, Jesus, that's really profound what he said, because I hadn't thought of that. I hadn't thought of, in particular, that people who, that reading their book would actually go, oh shit, that thing that happened 20 years ago,
yeah,
fuck, there's a name for that.
Yeah.
And I had written that off from my own mental health.
Yeah.
Or even, I mean, fucking hell.
Yeah. So, yeah, he is very profound. It's like living with Buddha, sometimes he'll go, and it's a lot of sports analogies, and he's like, no, on the field. I'm like, I don't fucking care about what happens on the field. But anyway.
But, yeah, it's something I spoke about on one of my podcasts recently about, we'll say the reaction around the Belfast trial and so many young lads that were angry about it, you know? Mm. And what I felt was is that on top of, we'll say, a misogyny, it's like they have very clearly defined definitions of what rape is. Mm. And for a lot of lads, rape is a physically violent act that happens down an alleyway from creeps.
Yeah.
And those same lads are actually quite like, let's beat them up with sticks.
Yeah.
But when it happens in a bedroom at a party, or it happens in a situation where it's blurred,
yeah,
they're not willing to take that on board as rape because it's too close to home.
I agree, and I think I remember reading a study, I think it was the University of Dakota, and they did this study where they asked like a whole series of college men, you know, if you could force a woman to have sex with you and no one would find out about it and there would be no consequences, I think something like 35% of them said yes. And then as soon as you said, but would you rape a woman, they were all like, oh, no, no, no. Like, it's like they couldn't sort of correlate. It's like, okay. And I think that is the problem. And I suppose as well, you know, when I was growing up, it was, you know, a stranger danger in an alleyway, you know, a man with a knife that was going to sort of drag you in, whereas actually most people will know the person who's raping them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember having, it's funny, I remember with the Ulster rugby rape trial, the text messages that have been going between the victim and her friend previously, they've been talking about what they would do if they got raped. And I remember a lot of the media was like, oh my God, I can't believe that, it's like she knew. And I said, women are always having these kinds of conversations. I remember having this conversation with a friend when I was 15, saying, what would you do if you were raped? And we said, if it was someone that we knew locally. And we both said, actually, we probably wouldn't say anything because it would be too awkward living in a small town. And, you know, you'd be going out and you'd see them and you'd be going to the same parties. And forever, you would be the girl who got raped. And so I think it's particularly hard in I suppose, small communities or in places like Ireland, when a lot of the time you won't just know the victim, but you also might know the perpetrator, and you're like, oh, they seem like a really nice guy. It's really hard for me to believe that they could do it.
But the definition is, because that person doesn't look like he has a knife down an alleyway with a big trench coat.
Yeah. And it's about trying to... And also, the thing is, I have male cousins who are, you know, 18 and 19, and I worry about them as well, because I mean, I've been advocating, you know, proper sex education and, you know, programs around consent, and there's so much resistance to that even at like college, like at a third level, and I'm like, it's too late. Yeah, but it's too late at third level. Like, they should be doing this because I think we're failing not just our young women but actually our young men as well, because I would hate to see someone like one of my cousins get into a situation where he didn't understand what consent looked like. And then did something that he will regret for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important. That's why I think education is... But the sex education system in this country is dismal. I mean, we had someone come into us and who gave us... They did like... It was like a travelling drama group. And they
is
did
this
like
when
this,
you were getting sex
ed? This was when I was...
I was thinking like last week.
No.
What are you up to?
It's been a hard year, okay? So it was when I was in Leaving Cert, so like not that long ago, and there was like this traveling group, and they did this little play about basically like chastity and staying virgins until you were married, and like legitimately for about 90% of that year, it was like, that ship has sailed, my friend. But like, it was just, that was the only sex education that we had in 6 years of school. I mean, that's just insane.
We had a priest that told us Didn't say anything about sex. The first bar was a fucking priest.
Was he talking about tennis balls?
What?
Was he talking about tennis balls? Tennis
it
balls
wasn't tennis balls. All he couldn't. He was probably supposed to talk about actual sex between humans, right? But he couldn't even bring himself to do that. So the gist of it was, do never wank.
Yeah.
And if you have a wet dream, it means that you dreamt about having sex with the devil.
That's really extreme.
It's very extreme, yeah.
Well,
and that was Limerick in the 90s. Yeah.
To be fair, at least he was acknowledging that he masturbated. I mean, for girls, that was like, oh, no, none of us do that. I was like, oh, fuck, I'm the only one. This is really scary.
So. Is that the same? No, because I find now, and this is one thing I've noticed recently, I find with adults, we'll say, not necessarily teenagers, I think female masturbation is something that's kind of celebrated.
Yeah.
And then male masturbation is keep that to yourself, lads.
Yeah.
But, like, there is a kind of a celebration around... I know now sex toys have been liberated recently and they're no longer looking exactly like a penis, which is a good thing, you know what I mean? But, like, if a woman gets a sex toy, like, there's sex toy parties and stuff, it's something to be celebrated. Yeah. If a lad decides he wants a fleshlight... No, but come on, like... You are not going to your buddies and saying, I got a fleshlight, lads, who wants to go? Can you imagine lads having a fleshlight party? But, like, it's not something to look at,
you
know?
To be fair, I suppose it's because women have been stigmatised for their sexuality for so long that we're trying to, I suppose, push through those boundaries so that when a woman talks about sex and about sex toys, it feels subversive in a way.
There's a liberation there,
yeah. Whereas when a man does it, it does feel a bit... Actually, it's funny because I was on a website recently that was selling sex toys. Sorry. Yes, yay me. And there was this toy called... It was so revolting. It was like a woman's torso. And I mean, it was really... it was just so... Anyway, it was just
a torso. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it was just the language that they used around it. It was like, you know, oh, you know... that you can just fuck her and then put her away. And I mean, some of it was like, okay, right, is this so what men want?
Did you contrast that?
And then put us into the cupboard.
What's the...
I'm just asking.
What then is the language around female sex toys?
Well, it's not, I mean, this was really hardcore and it was just, it was really degrading. And it, like the language was like, it was just really explicit.
So you felt that the target audience for this, it wasn't necessarily a man who wanted a masturbatory tool. It was someone who wanted...
Yeah, it's kind of the idea of, like, I could imagine, like, you know, like incels, you know, like these involuntary celibate, sort of this subgroup of men's rights activists. The less said about them, the better, on the internet. And you could just imagine, it's just... there's something really perverse about it. It was like that sex, like, you know, this idea of sex robots, and they robotics, I don't know, Institute of America did this study and they said like 30% of the men that they polled said that they would use a sex robot and 30% of the women said that they were really like against this. So, but I think it's, there was one, did you hear about that? It was like that Samantha, the sex toy at that fair in Austria. And apparently she got...
Is it robotic? Or?
Yeah, it was like an actual woman, like a sex robot, and they destroyed her. Like, as in, like, she malfunctioned by the end of the day. Like, it's
and
so fucked
And do you mean
up.
Just true overuse or true...
Oh, yeah, just as in, like, they were, like... And the guy who created her was really upset about it. like, how dare they treat her like this? And you're like, I mean... yeah, but she was, like, she just started basically just, like, malfunctioning because they were... like, I'd say climbing on top of her is what the description came out of it. And I think there's a real, like, obviously that's a very extreme example, but I think it's sort of indicative of a certain faction of men, hashtag not all men, before any of you start tweeting me. And that kind of, I don't know, and I think that was actually, and I'm relating that back to the Ulster rugby rape trial, because whatever you think happened on that night, I think the WhatsApp messages just really highlighted a very sinister attitude towards women. It's like they didn't see her as a human being, like, you know, the city of, oh, we stuffed her and we roasted her. It's nearly like they saw her as like a sex doll. And I think that's why I think some of these, it's just trying to tie all of these pieces together and just to see that they're not all happening in isolation, that they're all linked. And I think creating an environment where male sexuality is encouraged to be incredibly aggressive.
Yeah, absolutely. Aggressive and... You didn't hear the podcast I did about that, about toxic masculinity, did you?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, I was just trying to retrace my steps in terms of what was I taught about sex? Like, first off, like I said, sex education failed me. Don't wank, you're sleeping with the devil. So, like, all I had was the lads in school. And it was basically just, what did you get off her? And then also, the big pervasive thing is, Jesus Christ, I must have been 19, 20 before the conversation moved into women actually enjoy sex. When you're a teenager, a boy, girls, we think girls don't enjoy sex. It's a thing they have, and they reluctantly must give it to you, and you have to trick it out of them.
Yeah.
And that was the normal attitude.
I think young women are taught that as well. You know, I remember when I was having sex, I'd be like, I mean, I never do this. It's you. You're so special. It was like that kind of idea of like, oh, okay, you persuaded me. Okay. And I actually think that's really dangerous because, like, you should never have to be persuaded or persuade someone to have sex. And I think it's actually about teaching young women that not only is it okay for them to say no, but actually it's okay for them to say yes as well and to say, this is what I want, this is what I enjoy, and not to... I suppose that I feel like sex sometimes when you're that age can be, for a woman, can be very performative, that it doesn't matter about your pleasure, that it's really focusing on, you know, how they're perceiving you and how attractive you're looking. And also even just...
And it should be the other way around, because it's really easy to make a lad come.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, yes. And to be fair, that's part of the problem. That's part of the... Well, not part of the problem, but I suppose it's... point, I promise. It's just, I think it's the idea that I suppose that the male orgasm is like expected, and it's like, well, he's definitely going to come, and like, you know, the female orgasm, you're like, well, look, it's nice if it happens, but like, we don't have all day here. And like, that's, I think, should totally be dismantled and broken down, that, you know, it's really important that both parties enjoy it.
I suppose it is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
If someone walked in there, it sounded like you were talking about politics.
Yeah.
Right, let's go through these hot questions. It has to be so draining writing. How does Louise manage her self-care at different stages in the writing process?
The writing itself is okay. I tend to be really disciplined when I'm doing it, and that helps. Like, while I'm writing, I'll do like a morning yoga class 4 times a week, and I'll go to the gym like 4 or 5 times a week, and I'll, you know, I won't drink, and I go to bed really, or like I live quite a monastic lifestyle.
So that's all part of your process.
Yes.
You understand, if you look after you, then your brain will give you what you need.
And I need to have very little going on in my life actually to be quite boring, so that the main focus is the story that I'm creating and the world that I'm inhabiting while I'm doing it. Publicity, actually, I find, because I've had 2 books back to back, so I've been doing sort of 2 publicity tours, and I actually find that way more draining because you kind of have to, like, this is, you know, you sort of have to perform in a way, and I think a lot of that is, you know, people asking questions, and, you know, sometimes, and I've always been really open about, you know, my own experiences of sexual violence or my history of eating disorders, because I thought it was really important to destigmatize some of those issues, because I don't think I need to be ashamed of them.
Yeah.
But also, when you're being asked about it over and over and over again, and often, you know, sometimes they would ask, like, really, really personal questions that felt very invasive, and you'd sort of walk away feeling very hollow. And when you're someone who tends to fill a feeling of hollowness with addictive behavior, it's something I had to be really, really careful of. Because after the asking for it, when that was released, I did really struggle. So this year I've been trying to be much more, I think, mindful of just taking care of myself and prioritizing my recovery above everything else.
And like, when you spoke about there, okay, your own experiences, we say sexual assault, right? When you were writing, asking for it, was there a cathartic element of writing it, or was there a sense of it being upsetting?
It was upsetting. I mean, I think it was such an intense... when I write, I tend to... sort. It's nearly like method acting, like I'm really, really absorbed in it.
On the body.
You know, and I just... Because it's just easier that way. I feel like once I'm in a flow, it just comes. Whereas if I took a few days off and then went back to it, I would find it hard to kind of get back into the character's voice again. But that was definitely the most difficult book I've ever written, because I was just... Before I started, first of all, I had to sit my parents down and my sister and say, you know, this happened to me when I was a teenager, because I knew that would probably come up in interviews, and I had never told them. And they were really upset about that, obviously, even from the very beginning. And then midway through, I started having nightmares pretty much every night about being raped. And it was really intense. By the time I finished, it took me ages to start writing again, because I really thought, oh, I don't know if I'll ever be able to write something ever again, because it was that intense. But the other two have been a little bit easier anyway, so.
Did you get tempted afterwards to go, I'm going to write something mad that has nothing to do with my own life at all?
Well, I mean...
On Mars.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I suppose, like, none of the books are about me. Do you know, I suppose it's using certain things, and I suppose because a lot of the things that I have experienced are universal issues that affect a lot of women, I did feel like it was important maybe to use my voice or use my platform to shine a spotlight on those and to explore those further, you know, particularly obviously in fiction, even though I do it in my column as well. But yeah, I think that was why with Almost Love, because everyone kept saying to me, oh, what issue is the next book going to be about? And I'm a bit contrary, and I kind of wanted to, I think, just not feed into other people's expectations of me. So I, you know, wrote a book about like a toxic love affair, because I felt like if I wrote that, then I would have freedom going forward, like creative freedom to write whatever I wanted, that I wouldn't feel pigeonholed into this sort of role as activist, even though that's really important
to
me, but I didn't want to sort of like that to be the only aspect of myself.
And with Almost Love, now I haven't read Almost Love, but I've heard buddies talking about it, and like, from what I hear, the protagonist is really not likable.
Yeah, I guess.
Is that a conscious choice?
I mean, it's interesting.
Someone described it to me as a very intelligent 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
Do you hate that?
Unfortunately, well, I'd love it if it sold the same amount of copies as 50 Shades of Grey did. But
the gist of that book, just for the people listening?
Yeah, no, sorry. Almost Love is about a young woman called Sarah who becomes embroiled in a really toxic love affair with a man 20 years her senior called Matthew. And I suppose it's really about obsession and desire and gender politics and female sexuality. And it was funny, it didn't feel like quite zeitgeisty when I was reading or when I was writing it, but I think actually in the wake of the Me Too movement, where we're expanding now not just to look at sexual violence and sexual assault, but also just to look at, I suppose, sexual politics between men and women as a whole. And that's what the book deals with. But it's been interesting with Sarah, because a lot of people have come back and said, oh, I really hated her. And then a lot of people have told me, like in private DMs on Instagram, going, oh my God, I am Sarah. That's exactly. And I'm like, I think it's interesting.
Do you think it's possible that people hate her because they remind them of parts of themselves that they don't want to take ownership of?
I know, I agree. And I also think that when you're writing a book from one person's perspective, we all have cruel thoughts, we all have petty thoughts, we all think, you know, maybe unkind things, but most of us don't act on them because we're good people. But I said, it will be, like, I think, dishonest of me not to reflect that in the book. And I also think I really wanted to play with gendered ideas of how we think women should behave and how we think women should act, because I'm a bit of a people pleaser, and I think that has really been a burden on me, actually, is that need to be liked and that need to be, you know, nice and likable. And I think that it's really important for young women to going up say that there's all different types. You know, you can be an asshole, you can be lovely, you can be whatever you want, really. And I think the thing is that the male anti-hero is so well established in pop culture.
Yeah.
I just wonder if something like Breaking Bad had been written about, like, you know, if that was a female protagonist, I just don't know if it would have been acceptable in the same way.
Look at how people felt about Skyler in Breaking Bad, you know?
Yes, yes,
this,
she
this
got
is
more
a woman, like, her fucking husband's off dealing meth and being a total prick.
Yeah.
And she's the bitch?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. But again, we have so much higher standards, which I actually think is really, and it's funny when, you know, people say, oh, you hate men, and I'm like, I really don't. I actually think I just expect more from men than maybe what society does. Because I think at the moment we have really high standards for women, and we sort of expect women to be perfect and to be the sort of upholders of this moral standard. And then we dismiss men with this sort of boys will be boys. And I'm like, I don't believe that. I think that men are just as capable.
I recommended to lads on my podcast to basically, actually, I'll take it on to a question that someone gave me because it relates to this point. Does it bother Louise when men report that my podcast has opened their eyes, taught them about some aspect of male privilege and sexism, when women have been talking about it for forever? Or does she feel that it doesn't matter how they learn so long as they learn?
I actually think, to be honest, someone said this to me recently, and it was about you, actually. They were like, I feel like you and Blind Boy are saying the exact same things, but, you know, he's been sort of hailed as this hero, whereas you're this anarchist, radical feminist who just wants to like burn all the men in a bonfire and be like, women only. And I mean, that sounds great, but I think, and it was funny because I suppose I hadn't really thought about it, but I think there's a good point there. And I do think, firstly, I think it's really important that you are talking about the things that you are talking, because you will reach, you'll reach people that I can't. And I suppose the thing is that I think that we do need men to be our allies in this. We need, because, you know, in, let's say, all male spaces, in like the kind of proverbial locker rooms, that we actually need men to step up and say, that's not cool, that's not acceptable, you can't talk about that, and to remove the social currency from that sort of laddish banter, I suppose, in a way. But I suppose, yeah.
What I do is, what I find in that situation too, when I am calling out my friends, if I hear them speak about a girl, we say, and if they're completely removing her personages, making her an object, I appeal to their selfishness. I say to them, if you speak about that woman in that way, that aggressive way, that's going to come, that level of hatred that you're expressing, you're not going to escape that later on in the week. Mm. That toxic talk will result in a toxicity towards yourself, and it won't help you with the depression or anxiety you're going through at the moment. Mm. What you're saying about that girl, I know you think it's banter, but it's far from compassionate. Mm. And unless you express compassion for someone else or yourself, you're not getting rid of that issue inside yourself, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I do find that gets true, because it's less finger wagging.
Yeah.
Do you know? It's like, here is how this affects you too.
Yeah.
And then I find that lads actually listen.
No, I think that's great. I mean, sometimes it can feel frustrating when, you know, when even when you're talking about feminism, you have to say, oh, it'll benefit you as well.
Yeah.
Like, as if it's not just good enough that it'll sort of empower women, or, you know, that we need to, I suppose, bring women up. And it's not about dragging men down, it's about lifting women up so that we're all equal. And I can understand that, I suppose, that if you have had the power and if you've had the control and the status quo has, I suppose, benefited you in a way, that it can feel slightly frightening when that begins to shift, and you might think, oh, that I'm going to lose something of mine. And it's, we're not trying to take anything from you, it's just that we believe that we should have, you know, equal rights and opportunity, and that's all that feminism is about. And sometimes it can be really frustrating to feel like you make up 51% of the population and that you're treated like a minority. And I think that that's something that needs to shift as well.
How do you feel about performative feminist lads? Mm. Like, lads wearing a repeal jumper and going into a nightclub to expect a shift. It happens. Go to a hipster bar.
Yeah.
There's a lad in the corner with that jumper. That's a thing.
Yeah, it's there. It's definitely there. Sorry.
Do you think we should stop patting lads on the back
for doing
shit they should be doing anyway?
No, and I absolutely agree. And I think that is what, you know, even what we were just saying there, is that, like, you and I will say the same things. And because you're a man and because you're talking about issues that predominantly affect women, it's sort of like, well, we should give you a medal.
Yeah.
Whereas, that is, if because I'm talking about these issues, that it's as if I'm trying to sort of push my own agenda, rather than saying, no, this is actually about benefiting society as a whole. And just about fairness, I think, even, you know, since I was a child, I've always been like, this isn't fair. My parents are like, well, life isn't fair. And I'm like, well, fuck that. I think that we should change. it's, you know, and I just think sometimes it can feel as if men are, like, all things being equal, because I know sometimes when you talk about the idea of, I suppose, male privilege, and then you will have, you know, someone who let's say is from working class will look at me who's middle class and say, well, you have more privilege than I do. And I think the thing is that all things being equal, like, you know, class and sexuality and race, all of those things being equal, men are rewarded more and they're also excused for more. And I think that again needs to be tackled. And it's funny, I suppose, this whole idea around, you know, that you hate men, and I'm like, well, no, I really don't. But I do hate the system that benefits men at the cost of women and at the cost of, you know, people of color and, you know, things like that. And I think that the only way that we're going to move forward as a society to be a more fair, a more compassionate society, is to dismantle, I suppose, the patriarchy. So let's burn that shit down.
And how significant, in terms of what you're talking there and the progress, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how significant do you think repealing the 8 was to what do you think? Like, obviously, there's the evidence-based, now women are going to have access to healthcare. Mm-hmm. But we'll say the cultural, a cultural shift, like, is that going to make a difference, do you think?
I mean, I have to say, it was funny because I was canvassing and the results that we saw last Friday were actually, like, that was bearing out on the doors, you know, like, for every kind of five yeses, there would be one no, but I for some reason, I still thought it was going to be really tight.
Yeah, me too.
I couldn't believe it when the results came in. And I suppose, as well, what I found really frustrating throughout the entire campaign was that I kept getting asked, yeah, but like, what are people going to vote down the country, do you know?
Yeah.
As if we were too busy digging our potatoes to worry about.
Well, you were a representative for the Boggers.
Yeah, it's like, oh, well, hopefully Dublin will save us. So I think it was really wonderful to see that bearing out, you know, that there wasn't that rural urban divide that, you know, even with men and women. But also I thought what was most heartening was to see that the number one reason that people gave for voting to repeal was a woman's right to choose. Because I really thought it was going to be, I thought it would be the hard cases that would get us over the line. I thought it would be rape. I thought it would be fatal fetal abnormality. I thought it would be incest. So that I thought was just, I'm still actually trying to process that. And it has made me, I suppose, because I've always felt really proud of being from Ireland and being Irish. But, you know, I did an event in New York a couple of years ago, and midway through, the woman said, well, you know, Louise does come from a country where they don't have legal abortion. There was like this audible gasp in the room, and it kept coming up to me afterwards, and they were like, it must be very hard, the priests control everything, do they? And you're like, yeah, and like, oh, do you have electricity? How are they so? It's grand. So I think this reflects, I suppose, more the Ireland that I hoped that I lived in, and I think that that's really wonderful. But like, we still have work to do. Like, you know,
yeah,
women in Northern Ireland don't have access.
Of course.
And also, I think, you know, with the people that were on the anti-choice side, you know, obviously I didn't agree with them. I didn't agree with some of their tactics.
But they've all started volunteering for organizations that help children now.
I was
now,
just
yeah.
going to say, yeah, and I'm like, yeah. You know, you could not, I suppose, dispute the energy and the enthusiasm. And now it's like, well, you know, it's time to redirect that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for rape crisis centres, for domestic violence centres, for children who are living in disadvantaged areas, for Childline, for Bernardo's, you know, for the women and children who are actually alive today rather than the, you know, children that might have existed in the future. And I think that is something that I would really love to see, that their energies be redirected in that kind of manner.
And it'd be class, but my worry is they're just going to follow the American model where they protest places where abortions
yeah,
are happening, you know?
I know, it's terrifying.
Here's a question, right? I'm saying this one now because it's quite hilarious, the person, how they said it.
Oh, God.
How has living at home been for yourself? It's your self-image as a young, successful female author. Then 1 hour later, she responds to her own tweet. Oh, goodness, I'm so scared you'll see this and think I meant it in a mean way. I really didn't.
Oh, sweet.
I'm guessing she probably lives at home herself.
Yeah, probably. It's funny, because I went to university, I just could not wait to leave Clonakilty. And I, you know, I went to Dublin, and then I went to New York. And every summer, you know, I went to South and Central America, I went to India, I did a J1. So I never kind of went home. And then I think when I came home from New York, I was working for a fashion magazine over there. And when I came home, I decided that I would move back in with my parents, basically because I didn't have any money and I wanted to take the year out to write. And then when I sold the book, which was for pittance, so I couldn't afford to move out anyway. And then I moved back up to Dublin. And actually, I just started to feel really overwhelmed. You know,
yeah.
The success of Asking For It took me by complete surprise. I was, you know, going on television, I was doing a lot of photo shoots, and I started, because obviously having had anorexia, I started to get very conscious of like the way my body looked, and I stopped eating.
Yeah.
And I started losing quite a lot of weight. And I remember going home, and it was my dad again was like, we're really worried about you, you know? And I think there was a part of me that felt I just needed to go home. I needed to get back into focusing on recovery, getting back into like proper therapy, really putting that to the forefront, and I needed the support. I just needed them just to mind me a bit, actually.
Yeah.
And now I just don't want to leave because I've basically forgotten how to change my own bed sheets. Like, that's the level of laziness that I'm at now. But I, you know, it's like, because I recently was hoping to buy a house and it fell through. And they were both so funny. They were both really chuffed about it. I was like, I'm like distraught, and they're like, yeah, but we get to keep you for another while. I'm clearly a dream to live with is all I'm going to take away from this. But no, I think for me it was the support, and it was, I suppose as well, the way that I write is quite obsessive, so I need someone to say, like, have you had a shower? That kind of, you know, like, isn't
fuck
that sort of
hell
thing? Yeah. It's very obsessive. It's just me and the desk, and I don't think about anything else, and I can't, like, I'm a terrible, like, I left a friend's wedding early because I thought of a plot point, and I was like, oh no, this will work, and I have to go. Like, it's terrible. I know. You're all like, oh my God, I'm a terrible person.
Do you think that's because of the nature you're writing is so first person?
Yes, I think when I'm in it, it's really hard to think about anything else. Yeah. Like, I'm just so consumed by it. So I suppose as well as that, just it's a bit like when you're doing your leaving cert and you can't think about anything else, and your parents sort of mind you a bit. That's what it's like when I'm writing. So, and when I was traveling a lot as well, so I think it was nice just to come home and just have normality and not have to, you know.
Do you find people, I don't know, make shitty remarks about it, like?
About living at home.
Well, I'm trying to decipher the Irish attitude towards living at home with your parents. I think it's become normalised now a bit because of, like, in Dublin, a lot of people live with their fucking parents because they want to try and buy a house.
Yeah.
Down the country, you can't live at home because there's no jobs, so you have to fuck off to Dublin.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. Like...
I don't think... I've never gotten... I suppose the thing is that I could have... You know, it's not... Like, it's a choice for me, you know, that I could afford to move out if I wanted to, but at the moment, it's just... I needed that extra bit of support. I needed that extra bit of stability. And now, obviously, moving forward, that'll change. So I never felt it. And also, to be honest, I think I decided when I moved home from New York, because I had been so caught up until that point about the impression that I was giving other people, you know, that I was doing this job that I didn't really like, but I was really concerned with, oh, this will look really cool and people will be really impressed by this. So I think I came home and I was a bit like, I'm going to live my life on my own terms. I'm not going to have a timetable of, I'm going to get married at this point, or I'm going to buy a house at this point. I was like, I'm just going to live life the way it kind of comes at me, and do it on my terms. And so if people did think, oh, that's pathetic, she should move out, I wouldn't actually care. Because it works for me, and that's all that matters.
But it's so fucking damaging, that business you're talking about there, about living your life by someone else's expectation. Like, I mean, fuck me, that's really...
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's a recipe for mental health problems right there, you know? Mm. It is, like, it's. I spoke about it on a podcast. It's Carl Rogers, a psychologist, calls it the real and the ideal self. If you live your life in this ideal self, this sense of how would other people like me to be?
Yeah.
There's no way to reconcile a kind of a self-compassion, but if you live as you yourself would like to see yourself and fuck anyone else, chances are you'll be on a general level of happiness.
Yeah.
You mentioned therapy there. Are you actively seeing a therapist?
Yes. Oh, yes. I have I have an online coach, and I also have someone that I see on a weekly basis.
And what's the nature of that? Is there a specific type, or do you just speak?
Usually, because my life is quite dramatic, I just speak, and by the end of it, she looks like as if she's just been watching a soap opera for an hour. I honestly think she kind of looks forward to me coming in. She's like, what is she going to say this time? It's such a luxury. And I think, you know, I've been asked in certain, from certain people would say, well, will you have to do that forever? And I always say, well, you know, I like to keep fit, and I don't think that if I keep fit for 4 months, that I'm going to be fit for the rest of my life.
Yeah,
like,
of course. Yeah,
I know that I'm
going
to have to keep going into the gym, and I think that is with your mental well-being as well.
Absolutely.
That you need to prioritize that. And I suppose for me, like I've been this past year that I've really like thrown everything into my recovery. I've never been this well, and it actually makes me really frustrated because I had the money to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what annoys me, is that this idea that mental health and well-being and emotional stability nearly is actually only the preserve of people who can afford it, because therapy is a luxury that not everyone can afford. Or, you know, and I think that if we all went to therapy, we'd all be like,
and
Donald Trump
needs extensive therapy. If you're on a medical card and you go to your doctor with depression, they just fuck a load of pills into you. You know, and there's no
absence there's definitely like a role for you know, pharmaceutical intervention as well. But I think that we just don't talk in this country. And I think that was why we've always had such a history of alcoholism, is that people had all of these feelings and they didn't know how to express them, and they just wanted to stuff them down. And I know myself that, like, with my own eating disorder, it was a way of numbing out. It was a way of whenever I felt upset or stressed, or even happy, actually, I didn't want an extreme of either emotion. I just wanted to feel completely numb. And I think that's what all addictions are based on, an inability to say, this is how I feel, this is what I need. And I think we should be talking about this from a much younger age as well. You know, like
giving
children that vocabulary, being like, it's okay to express your emotions.
To even know what the fucking emotions are.
Yeah.
Do you know? I mean, when I was at the throes of my anxiety, like, I would not have been able to correctly identify Was I angry? Was I sad? Was I afraid?
Yeah.
It was all this, like a burning fire of unpleasantness.
Yeah.
But there was no actual ability to go, I am angry right now.
I know.
Or my sadness would communicate itself as fear.
Yeah.
And once I got a hold on being able to identify the separate emotions, then I could take ownership of them.
Yeah.
And get recovered myself, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
But we're not talking about that. You don't, like, I always say it starts at, like, when someone's about 3 or 4 years of age and they go to play school or whatever, and they see their friend in play school has got a new Tonka truck or whatever, and they're jealous. Mm. But the jealousy expresses itself as, I'm going to go over and kick that Tonka truck. That's what happens.
Yeah.
But at that moment, an intervention should occur where the child is told, I know you feel angry, I know you've expressed anger, but that's not actually anger, that's jealousy, and that has to do with your self-esteem.
Yeah.
You thought this person was better than you because of something they owned, and then your brain said, I am angry, I can hit them. But that goes back into, oh, I can hit myself later on then, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's poor emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
And that needs to be done at 3 years of age, because that's when that shit starts. We know that from developmental psychology. Like.
Yeah. And I think if you actually feel them, they dissipate much quicker. It's when you try and suppress it. And when you try and not feel it, it's like it builds up and then it just like explodes in like a really inappropriate way. I think especially with anger, I suppose, because a lot of women have been taught that, you know, that we can't be angry. And I suppose the flip side of that is that many men have been told that the only feeling that they're allowed to have is anger.
Yeah.
And it's like anger isn't actually a bad thing in and of itself. It's the appropriate, I suppose, expression of that.
Yeah.
And that both of us are kind of finding that quite difficult to do. To articulate it even.
So I hope you're having a good comedy festival.
Yeah. I'm sorry, this is my fault.
We're an hour into it, so usually what I do around now is I put a roving mic around the room if anyone wants a fucking question. Who's got a boiling hot question? About anything now. It can be about, we have a lady over here. She went like this. I haven't seen that since I was 7. Holy fuck.
Just Louise, in the context of the repeal movement, even in the last week, we've seen the narrative has been rewritten to the degree that it's become sort of beginning to edge towards, isn't it great that the men brought us this far? There's been 3 articles today that the NWCI weren't mentioned in, ARC weren't mentioned in, you know, and I just wonder how we can go about changing that narrative, because that's going to be our history.
Yeah,
you know,
it's, you know, it's really frustrating, and I totally see where you're coming from, because, you know, the repeal movement was a feminist-led grassroots movement, and I think it has been frustrating to see, I suppose, how the traditional media have tried to spin that, and have tried. I think it was on Marion Finucane's show last week that someone was asked, you know, who did he think were the main, I suppose, drivers of the repeal movement, and he named like 4 men.
Yeah.
And I'm like, come on now, like, at least throw Alva Smith in there, like, throw us a bone. And it is really frustrating. I think the problem here is that a lot of the times when you talk about history, or when you talk about the narrative, that has been traditionally dictated to us by like white straight men. And I think sometimes I know, you know, I've noticed even as an author, I've been pretty lucky because I've been reviewed very widely, but I know that friends of mine would say that it's much harder for them to have their books reviewed or taken seriously than, let's say, their male peers. And in a way, I think that we keep fighting to get keys to the castle, and I just don't know if we need to ignore that and just build our own. Because I'm not sure if they're ever going to let us in. And I don't mean that in a I suppose, really negative way, but I just think it's about us actually saying, no, we will take control of this narrative. We will write the oral histories of this. We will, I suppose, stake our claim in this movement, because we were there and we know what won this referendum and who the people involved were. And I suppose that is why I think that there needs to be, you know, when we're talking about like the media, or when we're talking about even like boardroom tables, or in the Houses of Parliament. That's why we need like representation. That's why we need equal representation. That's why we need women in there as well, to have a voice, and to ensure that voice, because we already have voices, but it's to ensure that those are being heard. So I think that's maybe what we have to do moving forward.
Why do you think it's happening, though? Like, why would they bother saying, like, writing out the... Like, I saw an article there, said this, I can't remember where it was, but Linda from Abortion Rights Campaign did massive work.
She's amazing.
She shared it going, like, they're completely writing out what we did. Mm. Like, what's the incentive? Like, why are they doing it? It's baffling. Like.
I suppose the glory?
Straight up agenda, or is it complete and utter ignorance?
I mean, it's really hard for me to answer that because obviously I can't speak for those people. I mean, it does feel like, I suppose, particularly in politics, you know, I suppose.
I can see the politicians going, let's make it about us.
Yeah, and in a way I can understand that because it's like that's how they will get re-elected, you know, as if they claim some of this glory. And to be fair, like Leo Varadkar and Simon Harris both did, you know, they did step
they
up.
They did at the last minute, but I mean, the thing is, and this is my thing with Harris and Varadkar, it's like, that's what you should have been doing, lads.
Yeah.
Do you know, we have to be very careful about patting them on the back.
It's no,
like,
I agree. And
you're minister for fucking health, like.
I know. And I suppose.
Like, what you want? You know what I mean? I said, my fucking bin man comes over. Like, you know, I'm not going to pat him on the back for collecting my bins. You know what I mean?
It was interesting. I'm not sure if any of you saw Claire Daly's speech. Mm. It was just so powerful.
And phenomenal,
and she was so right, though. It's like that, you know, as politicians, they haven't been leading. They've barely been following. And I just thought that was such a salient point. And I think, but politics in this country tends to be quite conservative. You know, it's change. Like, I mean, Savita, like the Savita case, that was 2012. And like, we didn't get a referendum for like another 6 years. Like, it does feel like everything moves at sort of a glacial pace. And I think it's just a fear of upsetting people and of alienating voters. And that's the problem, is that, you know, we've got this political system where people are elected because they'll fix, I don't know, the holes in your road, or, you know, that kind of attitude, rather than, well, what are they going to do on a grander scale? What are they going to do to move Ireland forward? What are they going to do to make sure that this is, as we've said, like a more compassionate country that's fair to all of its citizens, men and women, you know, whatever social class that they're in, that we all have, like that was in the Constitution, equal rights and opportunities for all Irish men and women. And it would be nice to see, I suppose, a political party working towards that aim rather than a kind of a cronyism trying to please, you know, the constituents back home.
Do you think that lies on the constituents to not be voting in Egypt?
Yeah, I agree.
But it's tough when they're going to fix the pothole, like, you know.
To be fair, it
but
is.
But seriously,
to fix the potholes.
Willie O'Dea down in Limerick, you know, he was anti-choice. He actually does good things for the community in Limerick, and when the people of Limerick feel completely ignored, and the Healy Rays in fucking Kerry, and who's that lunatic from Tipperary?
Matty McGrath.
But no, the worse than that, the fella who sold a lot of mobile phones to Dennis O'Brien or something.
Lowry.
Okay,
like, people vote for fucking Lowry because they're obviously doing something to the parish pump, you know?
Yeah.
And that obviously is the problem at the top. It's like, stop ignoring these small communities and we'll stop voting in lunatics.
Yeah.
I mean, people care about their doorstep, you know?
Yeah.
They do. Any other questions? This lady here. Where's the microphone?
I'm going to go back to Almost Love, and you said that a lot of women identified as Sarah. I'm one of them.
Yes.
Did you have any any men identify as Matthew?
No.
Many of us.
No.
Is he the older toxic man?
Yes, he's the older guy, yeah. He's basically, I always find it really amusing because he uses Sarah for sex and he's really emotionally abusive to her. And no one has ever said to me, oh my God, Matthew's such a dick. It's always like, Sarah's not very nice, is she?
Because we expect it out of Matthew, though.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, he's a guy, so it's fine. It's funny. A lot of people have said that to me, that they're like, I really identified as Sarah, but no one has said that they'd have. I mean, it would be kind of weird if they're like, oh,
that'd be very odd.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like
male.
It.
Do you know that abusive man?
Yeah.
That's me. And I just want that. Thanks very much for highlighting that.
To be fair, my go-to line now is when someone says, they're like, oh, you know, are you Sarah? Which, I mean, the conflation of, like, female artists and the characters that they create is just hilarious. And I always just say, no, I'm actually a Matthew. And then you can just see they go, just a string of, you know, men brokenhearted, but it's fine. So I think it's, it can be, I found with Sarah that I really I really like it when people say that they identified with her, because I wanted to create a character that I felt was the most raw and the most honest character that I've ever created, because I actually don't think we see enough of that with female characters. That, and I was told that. They were like, you're going to need to temper this. She's going to need to be slightly more likable. I was like, I agree. I was like, I think I all I care about is whether people will read it and say she feels real. I don't really care if they say whether she's likable or not, because I hope that the story is compelling enough to sort of bring the reader along with it. And it has been slightly annoying the way I think that narrative has taken over, because there's so many things in the book about, you know, grief. It's a study in grief. It's a study in creativity and art, and who gets to make art and who gets to call themselves art, and how gender and privilege intersect with that. And obviously it is about, I suppose, obsessive love and how women are conditioned to silence themselves in relationships. And I suppose it just felt a little bit frustrating to see a lot of the reviewers focus on she's really unlikable. And I felt like saying, well, you know, you've both totally missed the point while simultaneously proving my point. So thanks for that. But yeah, it's been interesting to see, I suppose, that sort of taken precedence over everything else I'm talking about in it. So, a bit annoying, but you can't control it.
I can take one more question, because they're going to boot us out of here, so a comedian come on and tell a load of jokes. There's one lone hand over there. The lights are very strong in Kilkenny.
I know.
That sounds like a Nathan Carter song. It does, doesn't it? I can imagine him releasing that. Yeah. The lights are very strong in Kilkenny.
Hello, everyone. This is a question for Louisa. Seeing as you live at home at the moment, do you have any kind of therapeutic rituals that you can perform only at home or near your homestead? And if so, how important are they to you in your day-to-day life?
That's a good question. And it's funny, when I'm on tour, I have slightly struggled. You know, I've tried to sort of treat it as a marathon and, you know, gone to the gym and, you know, I've done things like that. But when I'm at home, like, I go to the beach a lot. I meditate. I'll do, you know, I have yoga and things like that. It's much easier for me when I'm at home to, I thrive on routine. And I think that's part of having had an addiction and also anxiety and things like that, that it actually alleviates a lot of that if I have a very healthy routine. And I suppose it can be harder when I'm traveling or when I'm on tour or doing publicity to sort of maintain that routine. So I'm just really looking forward to now, once this is over and once the play has, not this particular podcast, once this podcast is over, I'll be done. But once stage adaptation of Asking for It is premiering in Cork in June, so once that's over, I think I'll be able to just return to that, like, level of self-care that I enjoy at home.
Should I fuck off to Lanzarote or something, no?
No! I hate the sun. I'm so pale that I... Like, everyone's been delighted the last few days because it's sunny, and I'm, like, cowering inside, being like, oh, God, it's awful. So, yeah, I'm too pale. I'm too pale for the sun.
Louisa O'Neill, everybody! Very much. This has been the Blind Boy podcast, and apologies for, like, the probably maybe six people here who came here for Horse Outside. Yeah. Sorry about that. But thanks very much. You've been very sound, and I hope you have a lovely, lovely weekend, and have a bit of crack and look after yourselves, will you?
So there you go. A lot of Marxism from a pair of cocks. Alright, so I'll see you next week, where I'm going to deliver you a proper podcast about a jacket and Nazi eugenics. God bless. Look after yourself. Look after your neighbours. Have some compassion for your neighbours. Most importantly, have some compassion for yourself. Yort.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.